all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I have always believed that everyone needs to be a lifelong learner. Not only does it make common sense to regularly expand one's base of knowledge and skills, but it can also be very exhilarating. One never knows from which unexpected corner good wisdom is going to arrive. Skydiving has always been on my bucket list. However, I also had to take statistics 3 times in college before I passed. I've never quite moved beyond that traumatic experience and decided to apply that knowledge to my skydiving plans. I decided I would make my first parachute jump at the age of 96. That way, if the bad statistic came into play, it wouldn't matter all that much. Then one day, I was sitting at the bar of my favorite watering hole next to a grizzled old veteran who was somewhat of a legend in the parachuting community. He had tested chutes and made thousands of jumps. I thought it a good opportunity to share my plan and the statistical rationale. He listened patiently, quietly, never taking his eyes off his beer. Then, without turning away, he said, "A sound plan. But imagine, if you waited that long to try skydiving, and then it turned out you really loved it. Imagine what a tragedy that would be." That story sprang to mind when I received a message from my friends at Bravo 748 Military and Combat Speakers Bureau. They had a fellow they thought would be a good fit for American Warrior Radio. Combat experience, involved in unusual situations around the world, a great storyteller, moved on to a very successful private sector career. They were checking all the American Warrior Radio boxes. American Warrior Radio. He had been a British soldier. Hard pause. And then those words came to mind. Imagine if you turned down a guest who had served 10 years as a member of an elite British Army unit who had served during the Balkans War, dodging snipers and mortar rounds while protecting a general, and was even part of an unofficial smuggling operation that saved hundreds of lives. A guy who has protected movie stars and some of entertainment's most elite names, along with royalty and Fortune 500 executives in over 100 countries, incident-free. Only because he hadn't been a member of the U.S. military. Hard face palm. Ladies and gentlemen, an American Warrior Radio first. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Mr. Glenn Burton.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Well, what'd you think of the intro, Glenn?
That was a heck of an intro. I hope I can give you a good interview for your audience.
Well, you're not my first Brit, but honestly, you are the first military member I've ever had on the show in going on 7 years who didn't serve in our U.S. military. So a very warm welcome to you. I'm excited about our talk.
Thank you very much. If it's any consolation, I am a U.S. citizen, so I know how to tone down that British accent.
No problems. We have a translator here in the studio ready to go, Glenn. And just for our listeners, Glenn is talking to us from thousands of miles away, 9-hour difference. He's currently overseas somewhere. I won't tell you why. Glenn, your career, your path into the military, as I understand it, it took several flybys of the Armed Forces Career Office there in your hometown of Middlesbrough before you decided to make the jump. What attracted you to the military? Was that something you always had in mind?
No, not really. I mean, I think once I reached the age of about 14 and a half, you know, I was starting to hang around with a crowd in my hometown. And, you know, where I grew up was on a very tough council estate in the northeast of England. And I hadn't been doing well at school. Got to about 15 and a half. You know, I didn't pass any exams really. So my only path was twofold really. One, to further my education, and secondarily, to get away from the trouble that I was finding myself in. And I would go down into the town centre on a weekend, and I'd be walking past the Armed Forces Careers Office. And as with any young guy, you know, you're nervous. You don't really know what your career path is. But I probably went past that office 3 or 4 times over different weeks before I eventually plucked up the courage to go in. And I didn't share that with anybody. I didn't share it with my parents or any family members. I just put it all on my own shoulders and thought, you know, if I'm going to jump, I'm going to do it on my own and provide that information to my family once I've made the decision.
Okay, fair enough. Now, I tell you, Glenn, your book that I just recently read, it's called The Glenn Burton in Harm's Way, Always Moving Forward, and it does really take the reader through a journey of your life and how you've come to be where you are in your career. I found, as I mentioned, I'm a lifelong learner. I found lots of things in the book. One that I'm embarrassed to say surprised me, because your military career started off with an organization that we don't really think much about here in the U.S. anymore, the Irish Republican Army. And kind of tell us about that. In your book, you talk about that you're actually in London, I believe it was, and your very first encounter with their methods.
Yeah, well, before all that, and even before I joined the Army, you know, I my introduction to the IRA came on the television when I was watching my uncle playing soccer. And what actually happened was two British soldiers, undercover soldiers, were cornered near a funeral that was taking place in Belfast, and it was a prominent IRA member that was getting buried. And they ended up getting murdered, these two British soldiers. And I was about 15 years old at the time. So I'd seen that on television, and it kind of helped me decide. I felt angry, very much like having spoke to people after 9/11 mm-hmm. in the United States, where people were angry. They wanted to go and do something and give back and feel as if that they could, you know, participate in trying to get some sort of action going against, you know, a very terrible organization. But then when I joined the Army, in my first year, you know, I became a member of the 1st Battalion Coldstream Guards, and I was on guard at the Tower of London, and it was in April 1992. And the Tower of London is very close to the Baltic Exchange in London, where this massive bomb was detonated, and I was on guard at the time, patrolling with a colleague of mine. And it was very surreal, because initially we didn't know what it was. Explosion, yes, could it have been gas, but mainland Britain at the time was under a big high threat from the IRA at the time. So it didn't take long before a telephone warning had been called in and they'd admitted it. But that was really my introduction. And not long after that, I went over to Northern Ireland and I was serving over there in the province. And it was a real eye-opener, because I'd grown up with this threat, and then suddenly I'm on the ground, you know, dealing with that threat in real time.
You spent some time also, and we'll get to this later in the conversation, but you also spent some time in Iraq as a private contractor. Is it just me, Glenn, or did you see parallels between Iraq, where you're on your base, you're in a pretty secure area, and it's perilous just to leave that area? Did you see any parallels looking back between that and kind of what you all were dealing with there in Belfast?
Yeah, I mean, the threats were the same, but the method of attack was somewhat different. The earlier days with the IRA, you know, there was a lot of sniper activity going on, because, you know, the British Army had methods that were very effective, but they were still taking casualties. Fast forward into the Iraq phase, you know, there was talk of members of the IRA training with different terrorist organizations. You could see elements in Iraq in 2003 when I was there to what I'd witnessed in 1992 and the years following. So I think there's definitely a lot of crossover there. But the most important thing for people like me and other, you know, security operators and members of the military is vigilance is key, because the minute you switch off is the minute you could potentially be saying goodbye to the world.
Outstanding. And there's lots of lessons in your book that the average Joes like us can take from that. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Glenn Burton. Glenn has had quite an adventurous life and great storyteller. We're going to talk more about that when we come back. We're going to move to the rather sporty location of Sarajevo. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're just beginning what I know you're going to find a very fascinating chat with a gentleman by the name of Glenn Burton. Glenn's life, both in the military and in the private sector is something out of the movies, which I guess would be appropriate because his client list also includes a lot of names you definitely would recognize. Glenn, we've interviewed several people that were involved in Mogadishu, and the next chapter of your move that I get the sense, Glenn, sort of really started where you sort of started to cut your teeth on the skills that you would later use in the private sector came in Sarajevo. It's hard for me, sir, to imagine a better example of urban chaos.
You know, it's a very good way of describing it. I was presented with an opportunity as a 21-year-old young soldier. I'd only been in my battalion for 3 years. And I was in Germany at the time. I was living in Munster at a place called Oxford Barracks. And I was called into our adjutant's office. And he let me know of a position that was opening up in Bosnia. And my battalion had actually been in Bosnia for a significant amount of time. And I missed that tour because of other reasons. And the opportunity was to go out to Sarajevo to work with General Sir Michael Rose, who at the time was the head of the United Nations Military Protection Force in Bosnia. And General Rose was somebody who had a great amount of history within the military. He was the former commanding officer of the SAS. He went on to be Director of Special Forces. And this was a man you wanted to work for. And the role was basically, as what we call in the British Army, as his Batman, which is to take care of everything in his residence, take care of all his stuff. And although I had no experience in that, you know, I was a soldier, I was an infantry soldier, I grasped it with both hands because I thought early on that I would learn a great deal from being around a man like that. I didn't give any thought really to the environment that I'd be going into because other than a Northern Ireland tour, I hadn't been in a major conflict zone. But when I went out there, you know, as I remember flying in from Split in Croatia via helicopter over the mountains and then into Bosnia, the white United Nations vehicles started to become, you know, very visible. Fires burning in different places, homes, office buildings. The threat was very real. And when I landed in Sarajevo, it became even more real when a volley of rounds went off in the distance in the mountain range. So I had to settle really quickly. I had to adjust. I had to learn the role. I had to meet all the different staff members from a variety of different countries who supported the general and his team. But it was something I either needed to learn or I'm going to sink. So I made sure mentally that I took in as much as I possibly could. General Rose was a very, very impressive man, still is to this day. But I quickly learned that he was a leader, a real leader. And I got to know his security team, his close protection team, started to spend some time with them, and we would be living together. You know, there'd be five guys and then me. I'd be working in a different role. But the team leader seen a lot of potential. And I still speak to him to this day. And he didn't transition me over, but he kind of adopted me into his team, even as a young guy, an untrained security operator. So what I would do is do my normal job with the general, make sure the staff were okay and everything was good to go there. But then when he was going out to these big meetings, I'd be joining the security team and I'd be learning on the job. And so again, I was 21 years old. And that's very unreal to be doing that.
Glenn, you elsewhere in the book you talk about, and there's lessons all the way throughout the book in harm's way, and I know you see yourself, and you've earned a reputation and the title mentor as you're out there teaching people. And I tell you, one of the chapters talks about leading from the front, and I despise, well, we won't get into politics, but for someone to say leading from the rear just doesn't work for me. So the General Rose, he's an intriguing cat, though. When you talk about leadership, I mean, this is the kind of guy that goes out for jogs down Sniper Alley, right? I mean, that was he really that fanatical of a runner, or he was there to fly the flag to try and make sure those civilians knew that it was going to be okay?
It was very much both, both ends of that. You know, he was a man that really had no fear, irrelevant of having a security team with him. You know, he would go out and he would interact with the people. We would go for a runs. I remember the first run I did with him. I thought it was crazy. I thought somebody was joking that we were going to go for a run down this specific place. But a run we did. And, you know, I was a part of it. And because I went on that first time, he expected me to go every other single time. But, you know, after that first one or two, you kind of don't realize the threat. You're just a part of a small team and you're out with a general and you're running and there's stuff going on around you. We get it. But the people started to see us. Initially, they may have thought, oh, these guys are crazy. But they would stop, they'd wave, they'd shake hands. And we were winning over hearts and minds in a very early stage there. And that went a long way to gaining a lot of good exposure for what the general was doing, but what we were doing in supporting him.
Now, I get the sense, Glenn, that he was also the kind of man that did not suffer fools lightly, whether that's the commanders of you know, the Serbs or the Bosnians, whoever it might be, in meetings or his own personal team. There was a reference in your book that this, again, is something I didn't know anything about. You call it Schindler's List. Tell us about that, and I use the quotation fingers, unofficial operation. The general was aware of this? He was not? Or...
Yeah, he was aware of it. Basically, it started before I arrived in Sarajevo with another member of the team, and it basically just built from there. And it was help for people who had no hope, no electricity, no money, no food, elderly people displaced from their families. And, you know, because I was working with the security team and I was interacting with them and socializing with them, I became a part of, you know, working in this operation, initially in you know, small little way, but building up. But it was an operation that couldn't be known at the time. And the only reason I talk about it in the book a little bit is because it was mentioned in another book by another member of the team. So it's not something that we took lightly. The maximum amount of effort had to go into each operation. But if we were caught taking out, you know, people who lived in Sarajevo and getting them through the border in our vehicles, then there would have been major repercussions. So, yeah, the good humanitarian man that he is, General Rose was aware of it, but it would never be done on official demand or for money. So there was a lot of good done. There was a lot of good carried out by the team in that role. And, you know, the sights we've seen in doing that were dreadful, but we gained peace of mind when we were able to pass them off and they were free and clear.
In total, Glenn, how many persons do you think were smuggled to safety as part of this this effort?
That is an unknown, and probably each one of us do not know that answer. But it was in the hundreds.
Wow.
You know, I'm not necessarily saying, you know, we weren't all involved in the hundreds. We'd be off doing one a night or two a night or whatever it might be. But definitely a lot of people were helped and replaced.
This reminds me, Glenn, what we had an interview with a fellow who founded the Top Gun program, and he talked about this unofficial fight club where they would just go out over an island off the California coast and challenge each other to air duels. And, of course, it was not endorsed. It was not official, and it was very much frowned upon, but they did it anyway because that's what they had to do to become good pilots. And this effort, your Schindler's List effort, that was a multinational effort, wasn't it? I mean, you had folks from lots of different UN representatives involved, or UN partner nations, I should say.
Yeah, it was a multinational effort, mainly British-driven, but there was a small number of other people who worked at the residency who were somewhere involved. I have to be clear, though, there was not a lot of people involved in this operation, maybe 10 in total.
Wow. Well, good on you, brother. I mean, you made a huge impact, and I'm guessing a lot of those people still owe their lives to you and your comrades.
Yeah, I do agree, but, you know, I was a very young soldier. I'm seeing and witnessing things and being part of things that I really had no right to be a part of and see. But because I got my head down and I followed the lead of some very good leaders, not just General Rose, but the close protection team that I was with, you know, I wanted to be like them. So I didn't want to mess up. I just wanted to do exactly what they were doing as best as I possibly could. And that's what worked for us.
Sure. Now, something else that worked, and I'm guessing, Glenn, this is a skill that you developed, again, that served you later on in life when you're dealing with paparazzi or whoever it might be. This idea that you roll up on a checkpoint and you have to really just sort of, through a combination of fear or the assumption of authority or maybe a little bit of cash in your pocket, convince folks to let you pass. Is that a skill set that served you well in life later on?
Yeah, but every scenario is very different. I mean, I've encountered checkpoints like this in Africa, in the private sector, when I've been on humanitarian missions. I've encountered them in the military. I mean, we don't want to be, you know, handing over money or goodies unless we absolutely have to. But sometimes you've got to grease a palm to make it smooth so that there's no questions asked. But I would definitely err on the side of, you know, making the right judgment with that, because it could backfire as well.
Sure, sure. I guess I was thinking, in fact, I just had an experience with a special event this weekend where I had to convince this is nowhere near close, Glenn, but, you know, I had to convince the guy running parking that the speaker in my car was very important, and if he didn't let us through and park right there, there were going to be repercussions. I was talking through my hat, but it worked. So I guess that's a little bit different than the checkpoint guard.
But you never know unless you ask, right?
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're chatting with Glenn Burton. Glenn is a former British soldier. He's got a great book out called In Harm's Way, Always Moving Forward, and is working on another book called Mumbai Down, which I'm very, very much looking forward to, which will be out soon. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very pleased to be joined by Glenn Burton. Glenn has had quite an adventurous life, and he continues to do so. He mentors us in some ways through his new book, In Harm's Way, Always Moving Forward. Glenn, one of the chapters or one of the messages in your book is never be afraid to make a change. You say some people doubted your ability to last even 5 minutes in the Army, much less 10 years and 7 operational tours, but it came time to make a change. And I want to, we just passed the anniversary. You alluded to September 11th. We just passed the 18th anniversary of September 11th. That was a big moment in your life as well. Tell us where you were when you saw the news.
Well, I hadn't been in the United States very long at all, and I'd arrived in Palm Springs to visit a friend. And I was leaving that morning, very early that morning, to go to Los Angeles to meet another friend who was a former parachute regiment guy from the British Army. And I'd done a little bit of security work with him. And I was at a gas station on the I-10 freeway that runs from Palm Springs out to L.A., waiting for a shuttle bus. And I just walked into the gas station and to get a coffee, basically. I looked up and seen the atrocious events unfold. But strangely, you know, when the first tower got hit, I was very suspicious about the size or the magnitude of that. But as soon as the second tower got hit, I knew that I personally was going to war. And I knew we as a country in the United States, in the United Kingdom, coalition, basically, I knew we were at war.
Now, when you say you personally were going back to war, Glenn, you were out of the military at this time, but you made the decision to go back in as a private contractor to play your role, correct?
That's correct. However, I'd only been out of the military for about 14 months. So, as with most people, you have a certain period of time afterwards where you're on call, you're on standby to be called back in the event of a war. And I thought this, based on the news reports as well, in the very early hours of this, with it being Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, I thought this would be big enough for that to be where I'd be called back. As it happened, that didn't happen over the next, you know, 2 or 3 years, but I went as a private contractor. And I felt as if that's something that I needed to do. Just like many people who weren't in the military, who joined the military, or who were in the military and who wanted to deploy. It was a collective, you know, brother and sisterhood that all wanted the same goal.
Glenn, one thing that jumped out at me, and I think it was in the chapters where you're talking about your time in Iraq, and you compare close protection security, and you talk about the difference between actually doing it and just playing at it. And can you expound on that a little bit? Were there people just driving around in Toyotas with machine guns that claim to be protecting people? That, because I love the fact that you've done all this without, over these years, without an incident. And I use the term incident very broadly, but you've never lost a client.
Yeah, well, I'm touching wood as we speak, but, you know, in the early days, it was quite tightly managed over in Iraq. But then as it grew, as different companies and contractors were coming in, there'd be lots of security companies that would be struggling for manpower, but they'd be wanting to staff the contracts. So, you know, without being too disrespectful to many people who were out there, a lot of them just weren't prepared for that type of environment. Doing close protection in a high-risk environment like Iraq or Afghanistan is very different to doing close protection on the domestic circuit, such as in LA or in London. It's a different mindset. Skill set can come, but mindset is where it has to start. And if you haven't got the mindset, then you're going to get into trouble, or you're going to get your clients into trouble. And what I was seeing, and what my colleagues were seeing of who I was working with, was a lot of people were starting to come in straight from the military. So all they knew was military standard operating procedures, and they'd been asked to work in a civilian environment. So there was kind of a conflict there, and it was causing quite a lot of trouble as these companies start to grow and gain more contracts.
Glenn, let's talk about the civilian side of things, because you are the only, and I, like I said, I've been doing this show a number of years. I've talked to hundreds of veterans and military personnel. You are the only one, Glenn, who can claim to have the line on his resume, kidnapping a baby from Africa.
Well, it was certainly unique, and it was somewhat unexpected. But I do talk about this in the book, and you know, one thing you'll see, and any of your listeners will see if they buy the book, I don't talk so much about the people I've worked with. However, because of that, you know, somewhat accusation of kidnapping a baby, I do address the fact that I worked with Madonna for a period of time. I did a world tour with her. Under the leadership of the person that I went to visit in Palm Springs. He was her head of security at the time. After the world tour, he and I were asked if we would go to Malawi with Madonna. It's basically just a humanitarian visit. And it wasn't until we got there and we started to visit orphanages that we learned that the plan was that she would in fact be hoping to adopt a child. And that happened, and it happened over a relatively quick period of time, in the sense that, you know, the child was chosen. They went to court, both Madonna and her husband at the time, Guy Ritchie's, and my colleague were just providing an overwatch. We were starting to get an increase in paparazzi because she was on the ground. But at the end of it all, after the adoption process was done, really, she had to leave for an appointment in New York, and I had to stay behind with the child and a nanny. But because she arrived in London without a child, they assumed that it wasn't happening, the paparazzi. But I was left in this lodge looking after the kid, and we were waiting to get paperwork wrapped up. And once that was done, I left on a private jet with the nanny and the child to South Africa, where we jumped on a commercial flight. And the paparazzi attention was just something that I'd never experienced before. But it wasn't very long before human rights organizations were accusing the bodyguard, me, of kidnapping the child, that it had been done illegally. But it hadn't been done illegally at all. It was done all above board. I wasn't in the courtroom, but I know what happened. And all the right paperwork was done. But it wasn't very nice to be arriving into London at 7 o'clock the next morning and seeing your face on the front pages of every tabloid newspaper.
They don't have
I
those in
the main story.
The Brits don't use tabloid newspapers, Glenn. Come on. That's more of a New York thing.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
With a lot of newspapers that I'm walking by, you know, and it was a big deal. But we'd only been in the country for about an hour and a half, and newspapers are going to print with us leaving Malawi, you know, 12, 13 hours prior. So it's very surprising. Well, it's not now, but at the time it was very surprising of how quick this just spreads and grows into a global story, you know. And I, you know, some of my family didn't know that I was out there or even who I was working with. I'm getting phone calls while they're having their morning tea and toast. We're just saying that you kidnapped the kid. What's going on, you know? So I had to kind of, you know, quieten them down a bit. And, hey, it's good. I'll give you a call later. But, no, nah, there was definitely nothing untoward in that adoption. And pleased to see that, you know, the boy David Banda's growing into a fine young man. He's playing soccer for Benfica, as far as I'm aware.
And I want to be very clear and go on record. I was using the quotation fingers when I said you kidnapped a baby. I know you didn't kidnap the baby, Glenn. I know you're a good dude, and that didn't happen. But when it comes to the context of protection, I would guess that's still, for someone like you, it's a very scary situation because you've got these swarms of media and paparazzi, and some of them are using some creative techniques to try and get at your client, but you don't know who's got a camera and who's got something that could harm your client. That's got to be a very a sporty situation.
No, you really don't know who's friend or foe, and that's where I go back to what I talked about earlier with Iraq. The minute you switch off, the minute you've got an issue. I've been on vacations with a number of different celebrity clients, one of which I was in Mexico with her, and she was on the beach, and I seen a gentleman out in the ocean in a small boat. And it was as if he was doing sit-ups. Every 10 seconds, he'd just be sitting up, and then he'd be going back down. And then he'd keep doing that 3 or 4 times. And as I looked closely, as he kept coming up, he had a long-lens camera, which I couldn't really pick out initially. And he was sitting up and then doing the click, 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 and then laying back down so he couldn't be seen. So, you know, I've also been around, you know, a lot of luxurious places where a little bit of money, people talk. And it's very unfair. I understand that they'll sell you out in a heartbeat, some people, but when you go through so much effort in making sure that the protective operation is in place and you've got a client who says, hey, I don't want to be photographed today, perhaps we should probably stay in the house then because we're really up against a brick wall with all the elements that they can face.
Glenn, you've worked with a lot of different people. Would you say on balance, if you can even, this is Ben's dumb question of the interview, how many of them actually listen to that advice? I mean, half of them, three quarters, but I mean, if you're there saying, look, no, don't leave the house or don't leave the hotel, generally, are they going to listen to you? I mean, that's what they're paying you for, yeah?
Yeah, you know, I've worked with some exceptional clientele. I've not really had any issues with anybody that I've worked with in almost a 20-year career. Now, for the first, you know, 7, 8 years of that, I was very driven with the Hollywood side, and I was working with a lot of different celebrities. I found no issues, no resistance. Ultimately, they know I'm looking out for them. And, you know, I want to be clear as well, in the early days, I was working for other people. So they would have their team leaders, and I would just be a team member. But as I grew throughout my career and become, you know, team leader myself and you know, taking on contracts, I never found any resistance, even with those who some people might think, you know, they're high maintenance. Not at all.
Glenn, I tell you, one thing I really loved about your book is there's a lot of lessons that, as I mentioned, that average Joes can take out of your book in harm's way, always moving forward. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about those, some other lessons there and kind of what our average listeners can take from that. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the telephone by Glenn Burton. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Glenn Burton. Glenn has had quite the adventurous life. You've heard about his interaction with Hollywood celebrities, actors. I'm guessing there might have been a musician or two in there as well. His book, In Harm's Way, Always Moving Forward, tells some of those stories, but it's really organized around these snippets of wisdom that all of us can take out and apply to some extent in our lives. Glenn, I'll tell you one that really jumped out at me, and I'm pretty sure, but I want to just clarify this. This does not involve someone who is or was a client of yours, but it's a great lesson, particularly for the young people nowadays in this hyper social media society. If I were to tell my listeners that just before they go on their next vacation, they should post a big old sign on their front door that said, gone for 2 weeks, German Shepherd at the boarding kennel, Julia on the dresser, come on in. They laughed me out of the studio. But one of the things you talk about in your book is how an example of someone who, much to their regret probably, did just that because they weren't conscious of the good and bad powers of social media.
Well, it's happened to a few people, especially with the celebrity side. You know, on one hand, they want to continue gaining exposure when they've probably already got 50, 70 million followers. I mean, how much exposure do you need? But on the other, they're opening themselves up to a massive amount of risk. And what a lot of people do, whether famous, wealthy or not wealthy, is they'll post, you know, where they are in the world or where they're traveling to or where they're checking in at. And there's always criminal elements. And what I have a hard time with is regular people, you know, you and I, we might have 100 followers, 200, 300, whatever it might be. But do we really know every single one of those followers? When it comes to celebrities, you're opening up yourself to so much more than just a potential robbery or break-in. You're opening yourself up to stalkers, terrorist elements. What happened in France with a particular individual who has an enormous social media following was something that should never happen to begin with, especially given the fact that there was a security team in place or a security individual, but there were massive failings. And I would say that that particular individual is very, very fortunate to still be alive today.
I agree with you. We'll have to have a whole nother show to start with that, Glenn, but I think that's just a good example of something that the average people need to think about. Sort of a more extreme example, and I'm very much looking forward to your new book, Mumbai Down. What is the progress of that? Where do you stand with that, Glenn?
Well, I'm co-authoring it with Mike Danvers, who was involved in that operation with me. But how that came about was I was in the United States, and I got a phone call when the Mumbai terror attacks were taking place, and I didn't know that was happening. And I quickly turned on the news, and I found out that there was a family in a particular hotel that was under attack. And I was asked to speak to this family, and I did. And my life changed pretty much at that point, because although I'd been in various conflicts, what I'd never been in was the remote side, where I'm dealing with someone who is in a very bad situation with you know, a man and his wife and their two young children. And suddenly it's my responsibility to comfort them, advise them and get them help. And I'm 7,000 miles away. And, you know, I looped in my colleague, Mike Danvers, and quickly we started to put a plan together, and we'd be calling in assets or contacts within the region of India. But every time we were getting through the certain contacts, we were getting knocked back for various reasons, not because we weren't popular. It was they were operational on other things or they were elsewhere. And we ended up deploying a team, because unbeknown to us at that time, that was a three-day attack. But we ended up deploying a team later that evening, and the team got in the next day. They already had visas, thankfully, because, you know, India, Mumbai especially, was on lockdown. And they managed to locate the family. However, on arrival, one of the operators was detained because he was carrying radios. And the Indian authorities viewed that as a risk, so they needed to investigate it. So now we had three guys as opposed to four. And it was 3 days, basically, of no sleep, lots of communication, lots of worry, even though we were confident. But we weren't on the ground. We had a team, and we were kind of pulling the strings to make them work effectively to get to the family. And, you know, we're watching news reports. There's lots of casualties around different sites in the city, seven different sites, hospitals, restaurants, train stations, hotels. Our priority was the family. You know, we would have done it for free, if the truth be told. But, you know, they were paying a significant amount of money to get out of there. Thankfully, that did happen.
Glenn, let me talk about that a little bit, because that was one challenge I had translating the lessons in your book, many of the examples that you cite in your book seem to involve people with almost unlimited resources, and good for them. God bless them for their success. Coming back to using the example that you, of the celebrity in France, what types of things, though, have you learned over the years that the average Joes like us can use? I mean, is it basically just situational awareness, or is it that mindset maybe that you talk about always, whether you're on vacation on a beautiful beach or not, you always have to have kind of another, you need to be conscious of your surroundings and how bad things can go bad really fast, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, granted, for the past 20 years almost, I've been working with extremely wealthy and famous people. But one of the things that Mike and I are doing with Mumbai Down is we're actually putting elements in there where the normal person can learn, lessons learned from that. There is so much every person can do, whether you're traveling or you're at home. Know your surroundings, know your area. Do your due diligence. If it's a family that's traveling to Paris, for example, know as much about Paris as you possibly can. What's the embassy contact number? Leave a copy of your passport with family members. You know, avoid certain places. Because in Europe especially, there are places to avoid. A lot of people think Europe is painted in gold. It is not. The threat is high. In fact, it's extreme. So there are so many things that people can learn. And too many people get focused on the fine dining that they're going to go to or the attractions that they go and visit. But what if something goes wrong? And this family in Mumbai could have learned so much more before the trip began. It could have took them half an hour to just study. If something happens, what's our emergency point of contact? You should always have one of them, regardless of your wealth.
Glenn, I tell you, the always moving forward, the title of your book, I really appreciated that. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but it struck me because I was recently in a meeting with some clients of mine where we were at an impasse in their project. And I said, you know, sometimes to move forward, you got to go sideways or sometimes even backwards to work your way around that roadblock. And Glenn, they looked at me like I had four heads. Why did you use the phrase always moving forward as in the title of your book?
No, from an early age, from 14, 15, 16, I was always hitting roadblocks, always hitting challenges. But sometimes I learned at an early age to take a step back, recalibrate my mindset. And if that meant going a different way to reach my objective, then that's absolutely what I would do. From people doubting me whether I'd last 5 minutes in the army to people doubting if I'd become a close protection officer because I was a young, skinny lad. You know, I've used that to my gain. And made sure that I'm always moving forward. I mean, even a turtle, as slow as they go, they're moving forward. And we can all do that.
Glenn, you're at another point in transition in your life where now you're really looking to focus to help other people based on what you learned. I think you mentioned it really came about on a close protection mission you were with a young man where you really mentored him. Where can people find out more information besides just buying the book? Give us your website and tell us a little bit about this new venture of yours.
Yeah, my website is www.glennburton.com, and then it has a number of different factions in that, mentoring, coaching, advising, as well as some information about the books. But I am doing a lot of speaking engagements now, working with, you know, younger members of groups or even military units. I've been working with a number of different military units, giving talks, motivational leadership. So I'd like to continue on that path, you know, both supporting military personnel as well as working in the private sector and helping and encouraging people to be always moving forward.
Well, I'm going to take lessons from your book, Glenn, and apply them in my own life because someday I want to be the guy who, you know, can have his adopted puppy flown in on George Clooney's private plane, too. That's my goal for now, Glenn.
Well, I've got a great dog, and I thank George greatly for helping to get it to me.
Glenn, thank you so much. I know it's probably getting close to the middle of the night where you are. Really appreciate you spending the time with our American Warrior Radio listeners, and thanks to Bravo 748 Speakers Bureau for bringing you to us. You be safe out there, brother.
Thank you very much, Ben. Take care.
Take care. Ladies and gentlemen, this and other podcasts can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Over 250 podcasts. Follow us on Facebook, check us out on Twitter, patreon.com/American Warrior Radio. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.